How has it defined you? Write down how and why you think the critical choice either clarified or distorted your authentic self. The task here is to determine whether the choice led you away from your authentic self or closer to it. Did it contribute to your joy, peace, and satisfaction? Or, as a consequence of that choice, did you give up some of those things? What did you learn about yourself as a result of your choice? Write a short paragraph of explanation. Review your interpretation of and reaction to your critical choice. Decide whether or not you believe your interpretation was and is accurate or inaccurate. As you did with your defining moments, test your reactions to your critical choice using the benefit of time, objectivity, maturity, and experience. It may be that a critical choice for which you have regularly blamed yourself has been distorted in your perception into something it was not. Your paragraph should answer, has my interpretation of this critical choice been accurate, or have I exaggerated or distorted it in some way? Now, go back and take another look at the age brackets and decide which bracket you want to address next. Work your way through each age bracket that you deem relevant. Remember the focus. You will have completed your homework when you have conducted a self-audit for a total of at least 7 critical choices. The fear-induced self-destructive determination that so many people demonstrate in suppressing who they authentically are is a never-ending source of amazement to me. When you think about how much life energy people devote to denying who they are and living who they aren't, you can't help being awed by the tragic enormity of it. What a waste of talent and energy. And, as if we don't do a good enough job of losing touch with our authentic selves and sabotaging our own lives by settling for what we don't want, we frequently and tragically get help from those we encounter along the way. These helpers are among what I call the pivotal people in our lives. Each of you have encountered hundreds, maybe even thousands of people who have had an impact in your life. Yet research has shown that there are as few as 5 truly pivotal people who have left indelible impressions on your concept of self and therefore the life you live. There are no exceptions to this pivotal people rule. Every person who has ever lived, you included, has a short list of these people. Once acknowledged, once identified as a source of such powerful impact, the effects that these people have had on you can be dealt with, but not until you get real about the role they have played in your life. It is also the case that the pivotal people in your life can be those who give you words of encouragement at critical times, who open up opportunities you didn't know existed, who unravel for you a problem you thought had no solution. They can be people who step up at critical times with great acts of courage and support, or can in 1,000 humble, simple ways demonstrate their love and concern for you. Sometimes they are the people who recognize in you a particular talent and inspire you to develop it. They may even be people you don't know very well, but whom you watch from a distance, and the way they live their lives challenges you to live yours with the same qualities. They can be people who love you when you're not very lovable. Pivotal people can be found in unexpected places and in unexpected stages of your life. They may be people whose influence is connected to the authority they exercised in a caring and responsible way during your growing up years. On the other hand, they may include someone you encountered today. The influence they've had in your life may be the result of years of steady guidance, day in and day out. Or it may be the result of a single act that they themselves would be unlikely even to recognize. Perhaps they entered your life for only a short time before moving on, yet you still carry today the effects of that encounter. Perhaps predictably, I have observed that successful people, meaning those whose lives are peaceful, well-balanced, and satisfying, tend to identify more heroes or role models among their 5 pivotal people. By contrast, people who live with pain in their lives tend to single out those whose influence was just as significant, just as dramatic, but who were their tormentors. It is also possible, and in fact not at all uncommon, that a successful person may attribute a great deal of positive characteristics to someone whose influence at the time was entirely negative or destructive. Yet the person accommodated or adapted that negative experience in a healthful and positive way. In other words, some of the jerks in your life may have actually toughened you up. They may have made you work hard to escape, and in the process, you may have come to appreciate meaningful alternatives. I'm not saying, see, it was all worth it. It builds character. You should thank them. That is absolutely untrue. Cruelty and pain are not legitimate teaching tools, no matter how tough or committed they may have made you. What I am saying is that the problems certain pivotal people may have inflicted on you may have, over time, tested and refined some of your finest qualities and brought them to the surface. The tuition was likely way too high. But if this is the case in your life and you found a way to create value from the pain, then maybe you have found meaning in your suffering. Okay, with all these considerations in mind, who are the five pivotal people in your life? Who are the five people who shape the self-concept that controls your life today, both positive and negative? Who has written on the slate of you in a deep and memorable fashion? As you think about these questions, it may be helpful to look back at the writing that you did for the previous sections on defining moments and critical choices. Your answers there may instantly reveal who belongs on your list of five pivotal people. If not, perhaps the mental associations or connections that are triggered by your writings call some names to mind. You may find that this exercise will be a breeze. You may have a hard time limiting yourself to just five names. Alternatively, you may find it very difficult to come up with that many. Wherever you find yourself, though, remember who you're looking for. These are people who have played a unique and substantial role in creating the person you are today. As before, take your journal and carve out some time alone to do some writing. You'll want to be relaxed, yet focus as you do the following. List the name of one pivotal person in your life. In two separate sections under that person's name, write first a description of the person's actions, and then secondly, the influence that person has had on you. In section one, first, identify with as much detail as you can the person's conduct or behavior that you now see as pivotal. You will want to use action verbs in order to make it as concrete as possible. You will be amazed at what flows from your pen. In the second section, describe the effects that you attribute to that person's action. What consequences flow from that pivotal person directly to your present-day self? The value of this exercise depends upon your giving a voice to connections and consequences that you may never have expressed in words. This will be information that you will need to come back to as we go along. So take the time now to do an honest and thorough appraisal in writing of all five of your pivotal people. Don't be afraid to write down your acknowledgement of a pivotal person's impact on your life for fear that it will galvanize or justify it. I'm not teaching you to play the victim and blame others for who and what you have become. We will soon be dealing with your right to reclaim the power that is yours. But for now, realize that you cannot change what you do not acknowledge. Be real, or you will forever be stuck due to misdiagnosis of what cancer is eating away at your authentic self. An important caveat here is that people who have been pivotal in your life may not fit neatly into either black hats or white hats. Someone may have had a profoundly negative influence on your life while at the same time having qualities that you appreciate and admire. Another possibility is that some kind of turnaround occurs in the life of the person who was pivotal. It may be, for example, that an abusive, alcoholic mother creates for her daughter a childhood filled with terror, loneliness, and instability. Eventually, however, the mother successfully completes some kind of recovery program and carries through on her commitment to stay sober. Recognizing the trauma she created in her daughter's life, the mother actively seeks out ways to repair the relationship. She asks for forgiveness and does everything she can to become the mother she would have wanted for her daughter. Now, in a case like this, you might conclude that the mother has been pivotal for wholly positive reasons, but that isn't really true. In short, you shouldn't necessarily think of pivotal as meaning 100% negative or 100% positive. Okay, let's begin the exercise. Do not move on until you have written your responses for both sections described earlier, as to each of your five pivotal people. Time now for a critical question. Were you on the list of the five pivotal people in your life? If not, why not? If your own name does not appear anywhere on your list, consider what that means. It may mean that your self-concept has been molded and shaped primarily by other people. It may mean that you attribute your most basic core characteristics to the actions and behaviors of others. For better or worse, you may have yielded your power, entrusted it to someone else. Maybe that someone took good care of what you entrusted to them. Maybe they didn't. Doesn't it make sense that your own name would appear on your list of five pivotal people? Let that be your goal for the remainder of this audiobook. You are about to turn to that area in your self-concept where your greatest power lies. As you go forward, taking up a series of tools that can dramatically improve your experience of life, think of what you're doing as becoming a pivotal person. I'm challenging you to take the steps necessary to put yourself in position number 1A, top of the list, first in the lineup of those who have and will determine the course of your life. If you have honestly and thoroughly applied yourself to the exercises in the preceding chapters, then you know a great deal about your history. By completing an inventory of the external factors, moments, choices, and people that have most profoundly affected who you are today, you've taken some huge steps forward in understanding your own self-concept. But I will also acknowledge that at this point, you may be reeling. You may be in pain. In fact, it would be a strange thing if you had completed your exploration of your external factors and felt nothing at all. That's because as you revisited your defining moments, critical choices, and pivotal people, you were almost certainly coming face to face with a number of the sources of pain you have in your life right now. But be encouraged. You have found the bottom. Here comes the power. By that I mean that your external factors are what they are. They're over. They're done. You can't change your history. But you can change your responses to that history. As I have said, you respond not to what happens in the world, but instead to your interpretations of it. Those interpretations take many different forms. They can be immediate and transient, or they can be deeply ingrained and long-lasting. Either way, they contribute to the chain of events that leads to your present self-concept. And you must understand in examining your self-concept that you cannot skip a link in the chain. Suppose, for example, that you were fired from a job. That was an external event to which you had some internal reaction. Let's say your internal reaction was, "Hey, I really hate getting fired. Not good, not good at all. But I know in my heart I did a good job and I'm a talented person. This just didn't work out." You're being realistic, and in that case, you're not likely to suffer a huge blow to your self-concept. On the other hand, maybe your internal reaction is, "I am such a loser. I blew it and got what I deserve." Now, with that internal reaction, your self-concept will definitely suffer. One external event, two very different outcomes. Those hugely different internal reactions create the possibility of two resulting impacts on your self-concept. Hence my point. You respond not to what happens to you externally, but instead to how you internalize it. That means you have a tremendous power to influence and control your concept of self. I'm not preaching rah-rah here. I'm talking about your internal dialogue, the real-time conversation you have with you about you. You have to be honest with yourself, but you do have choices. And before we're finished, you will learn how to make them constructively. Bottom line, it's bad enough if negative things happen in your life, but it becomes disastrous if they result in you kicking your own ass, making them worse. We need to begin by addressing what for many people is a point of confusion. When I start talking about internal factors, your understandable reaction may be, he's asking me to examine my thinking about my thinking, which sounds like a good recipe for a headache. It can sound really circular and impossible to do. Trust me, it's not. I'm not going to send you to the mountaintop without a map, asking you to contemplate yourself and your essence. I am going to ask you some very specific questions, and once again, I'm going to ask you to write your answers in your private journal. Your writing your answers is extremely important because it gives you a measure of objectivity. Confusion comes from trying to observe yourself and your thinking without writing things down. It's like trying to see your own face without a mirror. Now, that'll give you a headache. By contrast, when you write your answers down, you gain an external perspective of internal events. Your writing will become the mirror that reflects what is going on in your mind and heart. There's another concern we need to address right away. You may be thinking, hey, I just don't think that much about myself. Maybe I'm just not that smart, but I just don't think that all of this mental activity is going on within me. Wrong. I guarantee you all of this mental activity is going on within you, but some of it, not your internal dialogue, which happens in real time, may be happening so fast, so repetitively, and be so well rehearsed and overlearned that it is virtually automatic. When you have been over and over a process many, many times, you no longer consciously break it down into steps or thoughts. Think about driving a car, for example. You don't have to think about what to do. You don't even have to look or think about putting in the key. There are muscle memories and habits that are so ingrained that you do it automatically. The same is true with your thoughts. You can go through labels, tapes, and fixed or limiting beliefs at incredible speed. You can think through a series of self-observations and judgments faster than you can blink an eye. It can happen so fast that you may not even be aware that you're doing it. To grasp how internal factors can affect you, you've got to understand their speed, how automatic some of them can be. A good example of automatic, super high-speed thinking is someone who has a snake phobia. I'm talking about the kind of person who has a huge, irrational fear of snakes, versus the rest of us who may not love them or go out of our way to hold them, but yet don't want to jump out of a window if we think one might have come through the room once a year ago. I'm talking about people who panic at the very thought of a snake, who desperately try to escape any circumstance in which a snake even might be present. Their fear is so debilitating as to be totally paralyzing. Now, if you set this person down and ask him or her to tell you everything that is scary and hateful about snakes, he or she might say, "They're terrible. They're slimy, mean, and vicious creatures from hell. They can bite me and poison me and kill me. They have devil eyes. They're cold and sneaky. They crawl in your mouth and out your eyes. They make you scream and cry and wet your pants or worse. They're just horrible, cold and clammy creatures." These statements would be that person's tapes about snakes. Now suppose that while he or she was sitting there, you suddenly dumped a bunch of snakes in front of them. There wouldn't be enough time to process all the words. They scare me, they're slimy, they can bite me and kill me, they have devil eyes, they're cold, they want to crawl on you and make you scream and cry, they're just horrible creatures, and so on. They couldn't possibly think that fast, as you know from having seen or experienced this kind of thing in your own life. The instant this person perceives snake, they would instantly yell, "Snake!" and immediately lose all rational control. They'd go into a panic flight to get out of there, diving under the table or jumping out a window and hurting themselves in the process. Now, the point is that the term snake is a summary term for the collection of beliefs they have internalized about snakes. The term becomes a symbol that represents a whole cluster of horrid fears about snakes so that they don't have to go through a whole list of 5 or 10 paragraphs about why snakes are bad. All they need to register is snake, and they can instantly understand bad deal, and out the window they go. This symbol or summary term is so overlearned and it happens so fast that that person's body and mind go into automatic pilot. The same is true with you. Instead of snake, however, your term might be loser or trapped or useless. When I say overlearned, I mean the reaction or thought that has become a kind of shorthand. It is so well learned that it is high speed and automatic. And so the question arises, if these thoughts happen so fast, what can I do about them? Well, among the incredible abilities that you have as a human being is the ability to put your mind in slow motion, to hit the slow-mo button and cause everything to go in a steady, deliberate pace so that you can hear what you're thinking and write it all down. The way you do that is first by getting very quiet and very still, and second by answering some hard questions about how you think. By doing that, you begin to challenge your internal processes. You start to test them against some modicum of conscious reality. Once you identify what is going on inside your mind, you can change it. The one question that human beings probably ask more than any other is why. Why did this or that happen? Why did something not happen? Or if it did, why now? Why me instead of someone else? Why did the accident happen to me, not the next car? Why didn't I get that raise, that promotion? Why? From all that you've read so far about internal factors, it should be clear that they deserve a great deal of your attention. A big part of what I'm asking you to do in this audio book involves bringing your internal factors into the sunlight, taking stock of your interior reactions to and interpretations of your experiences. And to do that right, you need to first understand the particular mindset that you bring to the whys in your life. Think of it like this. Whenever you reach for a pencil, your being right-handed or left-handed predisposes you to reach for that pencil with one particular hand. You've done it the same way thousands of times from the time you were a child. In the same way, when you are faced with one of the many whys in your life, you have a characteristic style or attitude of reaching for that answer. You have a predisposition to answer that why question the same way time after time. This pattern of response, unique to you, is a characteristic that is called your locus of control. Locus means location, as in place. Locus of control is concerned with where you tend to assign causation for the events in your life. It's your accustomed viewpoint about where you perceive control to be. Everyone, without exception, carries around this perceptual set, this way of interpreting and assigning causation for the things that happen in their lives. You may not be consciously aware of it, but it's there. It's down deep at the bedrock of your self-concept. That's why we've got to address it first before any of your other internal factors. What's your way? What does your locus of control point you toward when I ask you questions like the following? Who or what is in charge of your life? Who is responsible for the results in your life? To whom or what do you look for answers or help when facing a challenge? Who is in control when things go wrong? When things go right, who gets the credit? You may recall that in general, people's locus of control is either internal or external. For the sake of efficiency, let's use the term internalizers for those whose locus of control is internal and externalizers for those whose locus of control is external. Let's talk first about internalizers. Internalizers operate from a self-concept that says, anything bad that happens is my fault. Anything good that happens, I make happen. They almost always point to something they did or did not do as the primary factor in the outcome of any event. In some way or another, the event was caused by them. For example, when an internalizer does poorly on a college test, she says, I'm just not smart enough to do well. I haven't got the brain power. Or she might say, I bombed that test because I didn't study hard enough. Either way, her explanation would center on elements specific to her, and therefore elements that she controlled. Now, suppose she scored well on the test. How would the internalizer explain her success? Right. She would say, I'm smart, or I worked hard and prepared well. Again, aspects of herself and her control. Now let's look at externalizers. Whatever bad happens, the externalizer takes no ownership of it. Whatever good happens, the externalizer takes no ownership of that either. In her view, someone or something else is behind all the results in her life. It might be the government, maybe it's her mother, but it's certainly not herself. Externalizers are stressed out, uptight, and anxiety-ridden, and they're convinced that almost nothing in life is within their control. For example, if an externalizer did poorly on that same college test that the internalizer took, whose fault would it be? The teacher's, perhaps. Maybe bad friends who kept her up all night partying. She might say the test was just too hard or it was unfair. She never thinks for a moment that she failed because she was lazy, ill-prepared, or unfocused. Similarly, if the externalizer does well on the test, it's because that test was easy, or the teacher was generous with grades. The externalizer's habitual response, her perceptual set, means she cannot give herself much credit, if any, for a successful grade. The story of her life is the story of other people and forces. Her self-talk will predictably be very victim-oriented. Whatever happens, bad or good, the responsibility is someone else's. Now I need to introduce a third category of locus of control, and that's the one I call chance. For all their differences, internalizers and externalizers have this in common. Both of them identify someone or something that they perceive to be responsible for the outcomes in their lives. Whether it's always me or it's never me, both of them have a deep-seated belief that there is a reason and a direct cause for everything that happens. But there is a third category of people who we haven't talked about yet. Call them chance people. In these people's perceptual set, every result or outcome is due to fate, accident, or just plain luck. People who measure high in the chance factor may believe in God, but not as one who makes things happen on a day-to-day basis. They certainly don't believe that they are part of a larger, purposeful plan. Things just happen, and there's nothing we can do about them. Consider, for example, their attitude toward death. In their view, death is a random, wholly unknowable event that will not change schedule regardless of how much you take care of yourself, how smart your doctors may be, where you live, or any of the hundreds of other things that could possibly affect your health. When your number's up, your card gets punched. There's no point in trying to influence or even change when and how you die. It just happens. When the internalizers get sick, they are likely to believe that they had some part in the onset of their illness. They take responsibility for getting sick, and they will also take responsibility for getting well. Externalizers, on the other hand, might lie there in the hospital bed, blaming their heart trouble on any number of factors other than their two-pack-a-day habit or the two jumbo cheeseburgers they had enjoyed every night for the past 10 years. They might blame their parents. I have terrible genes. Or they might blame God. You might hear an externalizer explain how he was hexed by an enemy, doomed by the environment, or targeted for attack by a government agency. And as you might expect, they cannot be held responsible for their recovery. Rehabilitation, after all, is the job that belongs to the doctors, nurses, and physical therapists, not to them. Not surprisingly, the people who fall under the chance category are the most difficult to help. They take no personal responsibility for their recovery, they have no faith in any treatment, and they see no reason for setting goals or for trying to get better. Lacking a reason for effort, they have little or no motivation. The onset of disease is an accidental occurrence, a card played from the game of chance. Nothing and no one is responsible other than the accidental combination of events. It was just the luck of the draw. You were in the wrong place at the wrong time. As important as your health is, make no mistake, the issue at hand is about far more than your health. Understanding and addressing your own locus of control has implications for your physical well-being, certainly, but it touches on every other area of your life. It directly influences the content and quality of every moment that you live. Where you place the causes for the events in your life affects all of the big things, your career, your effectiveness as a parent, your marriage, and yes, your health. If you are consistently and repeatedly attributing events in those areas to the wrong causes, then there can be no doubt that you are living a fictional self. So, in which perceptual category do you place yourself? Where do you assign responsibility for your performance in life? Are you making your life choices based on your responsibility or someone else's? Are you waiting around hoping that whoever you've assigned to manage your life will be smart enough to do it well? Time for a reality check. Since I tend to speak a great deal about your being responsible for the way your life works, you would probably assume that I would vote for the internalizer as the person most likely to succeed on the road to authenticity. It is true, as I've said many times, that you create your own experience. But actually, there are defects in every locus of control. Neither the externalizer, the chance person, nor the internalizer can claim to have the perfect viewpoint. There are flaws inherent in all three. I believe anyone's authentic self is one in which you would naturally want to take control of your life and your reactions to the events that happen to you, but be realistic about what you can control and what you can't. Suppose you're enjoying a baseball game when 2,000 miles away, your elderly parent drops dead at home of a sudden heart attack. You'd be wrongly internalizing that event if you said, "Oh, if I had only been there, Dad might still be alive. I blame myself for what happened." Nonsense. If you buy into this stuff, if you choose to internalize events and behaviors that you do not control, then you're setting yourself up for years of depression and needless pain. And when you think about this kind of reaction, there can actually be a streak of arrogance in it. It's as if you're saying the sun can't rise without your permission, that the planets orbit at your command. I mean, let's be rational here. There are things you can control and things you can't. What about the externalizers? Can their locus of control create problems for them? Clearly, yes. Negative external attribution can be extremely destructive. For example, a binge-spending externalizer on the verge of financial collapse might say, "I guess that God just wants me to go bankrupt. It's God's will." Imagine the consequences that flow from that kind of thinking. If you were an externalizer and one of your parents died, you might perceive that some major force was responsible. You would probably become angry at that outside force and rage at its injustice. You might say, "Why does God despise me? He has punished me in the worst way. I can't imagine what I've done to deserve this pain." Inappropriate blame never addresses the heart of the problem. If you misdiagnose a situation, you will also mistreat that situation and fail to do what is actually and realistically called for. Remember, to be authentic in your thinking, you must deal with facts and only the facts. Similarly, scoring high on the chance scale cripples your self-concept and sets you up for obvious problems. If your approach tends to be, "What difference does it make?" then you're likely to spend your life on the sidelines. Chance people, not surprisingly, strike others as being lazy and uninvolved in life. They miss crucial opportunities to make a difference in their own lives and to align themselves more closely with their authentic selves. There is no authenticity in a life left to chance. Okay. By this time, I trust that you're becoming comfortable with the concept of locus of control. It's time to take out your journal and write down which of the three types you think best describe you. Do you have an internal locus of control, an external locus of control, or a chance locus of control? How does your locus of control influence you on a daily basis? Are you satisfied with your locus of control and its effect on your authentic self? In examining your locus of control, we've been talking about the particular style with which you interpret and respond to the events in your life. Knowledge is power, and knowing what your style is will give you a new measure of power in your life. It's a critical first step in addressing your internal factors. As we proceed through the sections that follow, you'll start to be more conscious of your tendency to answer those whys in your life in a patterned fashion. You'll recognize opportunities to question whatever your personal tendency and locus of control is. You'll begin putting the cause of an event where that cause belongs rather than reaching for that why in your old familiar way. I hope you've seen, too, that arrogance and victimhood are twin imposters that dwell within your fictional self and can jerk you around at every turn. Mistakenly internalizing causes means that you'll be arrogantly claiming ownership of everything that happens in your life, good or bad, without regard to the facts. Quit doing that. You cannot change the fact that your parent died, your spouse left you, or that a hurricane is happening in Florida. If you insist otherwise, you'll be rebuilding your fictional self. Once again, you'll be drifting away from your authentic self. Distinguish the things you can control from those you can't. As for those things you can control, which is most of them, you are starting to see that you can no longer play the victim. It's like that old saying, God don't drive no parked cars. You cannot continue to sit in a parking lot. Your authentic self is summoning you, and it's time to get moving. Let's continue to work through whatever may be keeping you from doing so. As we look at the world and ourselves, we do it through a set of filters. Think about what a filter is. A filter is a mechanism that lets some things flow in, but screens other things out. Depending on what the filter is made up of, it can also alter whatever is looked at or passes through it. Sunglasses are a good example of a visual filter. But obviously, I'm not talking here about some physical apparatus that we can put on and take off like a pair of glasses. In fact, the filters I'm talking about are not really visual in nature. They are internal and are mental, emotional, verbal, and perceptual in nature. Through them, we process and assign a weight and meaning to every event in our lives. Some things flow in, others are screened out. Everything is affected. Our filters affect not just what we see, but what we hear and believe. Now, because we trust ourselves to be honest and because we think we don't lie to ourselves, we tend to believe that our filtered perceptions are an accurate depiction of reality. Whatever passes through the filter, accurate or not, is what we tend to believe. As a result, even when our filtered perceptions lie, we get suckered big time. So here's a warning. When it comes to any of your untested and unchallenged perceptions, you should be afraid. Be very afraid. You could very well be seeing yourself in a distorted light. For example, in your life right now, there may be lots of people who believe in and encourage you. Your supporting cast may number in the hundreds. Yet I'd be willing to bet that if you have even one or two critics, one or two naysayers, those noisy few can command your full attention, often drowning out the effects of all the positive input. Why? Because it hurts to be rejected, criticized, and attacked, and you pay attention to pain. Your filters are sensitized to painful threats, and you see those threats to your self-concept more vividly and memorably than you see anything else. Just as importantly, they linger. Those negatives tend to stay with you for years. Your filters explain a lot about how your past reaches into your present. For example, if even some of the people in your life have caused you significant pain, you may internally react in a way that it gets to you and causes you to ignore the more positive majority and view the world through a filter that sees all people as a threat or potential harm. Maybe you have wrongly concluded you got hurt because you deserved it. Inappropriate internal locus of control. Or at a minimum that you must accept it. Either way, that negative history changes who you are. You let them convince you they are right, and essentially, you join the critics in dogging on you. An additional problem is that a distorted life feels more and more natural the longer you live it. Put another way, a lie unchallenged soon becomes the truth. your filters start to feel perfectly normal to you, and the things you see through them start to look perfectly normal too. But are they? Or do they only look that way because it's been so long since you had an unobstructed view of who you are and what you really care about that you don't even recognize what's real anymore? Bottom line, if you fail to test the perceptions that flow through and from your filters, you could make serious errors in judgment because your perceptions, born from a history of fear and pain, may very well be flat wrong and could be ignoring what is really out there for you. And when it's your life we're talking about, you don't have room to be flat wrong. The analogy of filters is a helpful way of thinking about perception and about how you color your perceptions of self and the world. It's a useful concept, but it is also just that, a concept. It gets us only part of the way to a working understanding of how the way you perceive things affects your self-concept in life. To demystify the process further, by clarifying what really happens within you, we need to get real about your self-talk. That's because as information flows through your filter, it takes the form of words. It becomes an internal dialogue, a conversation that you have with yourself. Again, internal dialogue is the real-time conversation that you have with yourself about everything that's going on in your life. It encompasses all of your self-talk, every syllable of it, whether positive and rational or self-destructive and negative. Internal dialogue is what you are saying to yourself, and about the world right now. Everything you were saying to yourself before you turned on this audiobook and everything you will say to yourself once you turn it off. In other words, your filters are actually a voice that no one hears but you. For future reference, that also means that no one can control it except you. Let's look now in greater detail at some of the fundamental characteristics of internal dialogue. First, your internal dialogue is constant. The time you spend with other people, even those who share most intimately in your life, cannot compare with the time you spend with yourself. You are with yourself 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And throughout your waking moments, your internal dialogue is active and you never stop saying things to yourself. Second, your internal dialogue happens in real time. Unlike those lightning-fast, overlearned, automatic thoughts that I will discuss in detail later, your internal dialogue happens at normal speed. If it could somehow be broadcast live, you would hear your internal dialogue unfolding at the same rate as any other conversation. Third, your internal dialogue triggers a physiological change. As a result of every thought you have, there is a physical reaction. If your internal dialogue is telling you that you can't succeed, that you're about to embarrass yourself, the physical response might be sweaty palms, a tic, or an uncontrollable shiver. Fourth, your internal dialogue is heavily influenced by your locus of control. So, for example, if you're an externalizer, a lot of your self-talk might sound like, I can't do this, someone else will just have to fix it. If you're an internalizer, on the other hand, you might be saying, I cannot afford for anyone to screw this project up. Better just stay here till midnight and do the whole thing myself. Fifth, your internal dialogue tends to be totally monopolistic. Internal dialogue crowds out or drowns out any other data from any other source. Because after all, this information is coming from you and you pay close attention to yourself because you wouldn't lie or mislead yourself, or would you? As a result, you may spend time lost in the hustle, bustle, and frantic self-talk that goes with it. You may be condemning yourself for not keeping up or obsessing about what you didn't do or could have done better. You may be cheerleading yourself with an endless rah-rah session. Meanwhile, if your internal dialogue is really active, it can become so loud and pervasive that you fail to see important events going on all around you. You fail to hear what may be important messages from others. You might miss real opportunities for success or signals that you need to recognize in order to avoid danger. And here's what may be the most troubling self-talk characteristic of all. Your negative internal dialogue gets the loudest when you need it the least. It gets the loudest when the pressure's on, when you find yourself in a difficult or deteriorating situation. Negative self-talk, if you listen to it at pivotal moments, can change your life forever. You end up being your own worst enemy. Because internal dialogue is relentless and ever-present, it can, in the aggregate, be a major life force. It can wreak a destruction that is cumulative, subtle, and slow. Daily exposure to negative internal dialogue, like prolonged exposure to the sun, can be killing you without your even knowing it. Ultimately, what you create for yourself is a toxic internal environment, one that grows by such indiscernible steps that it just kind of sneaks up on you. Remember that when I say killing you, I mean it literally. When you are mentally and emotionally at war with yourself, it changes your physiology. It takes years off your life and makes you so much more susceptible to disease. How? Your immune cells are closely related to your nerve cells, and there is instant communication between the two types of cells. For every thought you have an instantaneous change in your physical body. If you are thinking negative and self-defeating thoughts about yourself, you will have a corresponding negative and defeating physiology. It might take the form of increased endocrine activity, chronic adrenaline arousal, elevated blood pressure, or even a heart attack. In summary, internal dialogue is powerful medicine. You need to listen to your body because it damn sure listens to you. Your body speaks to you through your headaches, your painful back, your depression and anxieties, even your constant colds. It informs you and confirms what you're saying to yourself. And when you think about it, you see that these messages are your authentic self crying, "Help me out of here!" There's an emotional cost to negative self-talk as well, a kind of hardening of your psychological arteries. As we saw when the locus of control is out of whack, negative internal dialogue will cause you to overlook vital information that could otherwise be so incredibly powerful. You don't even recognize positive alternatives anymore because once again, your data processing center has closed. Result? The stimulus you are is the result you get. Your negative internal dialogue steers you away from the truth. It poisons your self-concept until the frustrated, unhappy person that you present to the world is the person that the world responds to. The world responds with more frustration and unhappiness for you. A negative internal dialogue becomes a vicious circle of self-fulfilling prophecy. So where does your internal dialogue get its information? What are its sources or its inputs? Because we are a society of people who don't really know ourselves, we are highly vulnerable to input from all kinds of external sources. Parents, peers, authority figures, newspapers, magazines, TV ads, Hollywood, and the internet. If we really knew ourselves, who we were, what we believed, what we didn't believe, what we were all about, then we wouldn't be casting about allowing someone or something to define us from the outside in. My dad used to say, "Son, if you don't stand for something, you'll fall for anything." As usual, he was right. If you don't know yourself and stand up for who and what you are, then the door is open for you to be influenced and dragged away from who you really are. The more those external sources are able to influence us, the more our internal dialogue is reactive to outside influence rather than reflective of who we know we are, and the farther we stray from our authentic selves. Somebody can give us some unfounded and unthinking criticism, commit some selfish act, or make some offhand comment, and damned if we don't let it get to us. The next thing we know, we start reactively including it in our internal dialogue. Like a child falling in with bad company, we might never initiate such negative internal dialogue on our own, but because we don't really, really know who we are vulnerable to its getting a foothold when it is started by someone else. That's why it's so critical that we stay committed to living in accordance with our authentic selves. Your internal dialogue will have certain predictable themes. Let's say you're convinced that you're just too heavy, or that you just don't look good in your clothes. If that's the case, then your internal dialogue is likely to be pretty much the same whenever you enter a social environment, whether it's work, the grocery store, a wedding, or God forbid, the swimming pool down at the park with that skinny bitch from next door parading her narrow ass all over the place. Your internal dialogue may include constant comparisons, fear, worry, anxiety, and pessimism. You may downplay something that you really care about by generating a dialogue that is marked by a false sense of apathy. After all, if you just don't care, it won't hurt if you don't get it, right? So to protect yourself, your internal dialogue will convince you that you don't care. It will clutter up your mind with all kinds of BS every time you try to do something that is not a lay-down, slam-dunk sure thing. As you think about negative internal dialogue generally, and more specifically as you begin to take stock of your own, you may logically wonder, if it's negative, why do I keep doing it? If this behavior is toxic, then why do I persist in it? The first answer has to do with the power of the negative. Negative information can seem more vivid, more real, than even truthful information that is positive. But you also need to keep in mind the power of the payoff. Let's say your internal dialogue is stagnant in tone and message, telling you to just accept who and what you are. You may think you hate that kind of self-talk, but trust me, you wouldn't listen to it for 1 minute if you weren't getting something out of it. The question becomes, what is this payoff that has you doing that which you don't consciously want to do? Well, maybe you're avoiding change because change involves risk. We should talk more about this issue of risk. We perceive risks and therefore talk about them internally in almost any change we undertake. No wonder we are so stubbornly resistant to change. Your internal dialogue can become self-defeating even if your problem is as simple as being stuck in a job that you despise. Simply to consider going after a different job, a better job, involves risk. The huge risk that lies in admitting that what you have is no longer what you want. Once your internal dialogue acknowledges that, you can no longer bury your head in the sand and hide in denial. Instead, you're now faced with the stark reality that your life work is the pits. This is where your internal dialogue can cause real trouble. When the possibilities that life presents are interpreted through your internal dialogue as being scary and painful, it's easy to become paralyzed. Instead of getting real and confronting your life, you can begin to lie to yourself and live a fiction. Your fictional dialogue becomes, "This is really okay. I know it's not me, but hey, I should be glad I have a job at all. I would like to contribute, but I don't believe very much in myself." Bingo, there's your payoff. You get to hide from the truth and avoid the fear and pain and pressure of reaching. On the other hand, please understand, it's entirely possible for internal dialogue to be quite rational and productive. Those criteria, rational and productive, may need some explanation. They can help you to be clear about what positive internal dialogue is and is not. We saw earlier that negative internal dialogue has physiological consequences. It can result in chronic adrenaline arousal, elevated blood pressure, and so on. It stands to reason, then, that if you are thinking rationally positive and empowering thoughts, each cell in your body responds with more positive and empowering energy. Sports psychologists have been studying this mind-body connection for years. Their research has shown again and again that the thoughts we have about how we are going to perform a physical event determine how well we do it. For example, weightlifters lift more when they hold self-affirming thoughts. Now, let's consider what positive internal dialogue is not. Positive internal dialogue, as I suggested earlier, is rationally optimistic self-talk, not unfounded rah-rah hype. Positive internal dialogue consists of thoughts, messages, and fact-based rhetoric that allow you to live in accordance with reality, not lies, assumptions, or opinions. Internal dialogue is truthful engagement with the world, not smiley-faced denial. You may know people, for example, who experience no fear whatsoever, even when they ought to. That is not even close to what I call positive, healthy internal dialogue. I call these fools the bulletproof people. They think they're immortal. Their brand of internal dialogue is just as dangerous as the kind that unduly criticizes. Look, this internal dialogue business is not an exercise in blind affirmation. It comes back to your personal truth, and you know by now that that is a truth that you live. Lie to yourself, and you will pay the price. Whether your personal lie is one of denial, self-derogation, or a bunch of rah-rah hype, it is still a lie. Knowledge is power. Positive internal dialogue allows you to know your history, yet move beyond it. It allows you to rise above your raisin. I think about my dad. As I've said, he was the first person on either side, my mother's family or his, ever to go to college. He rose above his raisin. I'd be willing to bet that his internal dialogue day after day went something like this. Poor and uneducated is our pattern. That's who we are. Well, I'm rising above that. I'm fighting my way up off of this rung of the ladder. I'm fighting my way out of here. Positive internal dialogue is what propels the Olympic athlete to a new personal best. It's as if the energy generated by all of that affirming self-talk is what carries him or her to another level of achievement. Afterwards, the athlete can recall only that he or she was totally engrossed in the moment. I trust that you're now ready to go on the alert as to your own internal dialogue and to find out exactly what it is that you tell yourself. As before, you're going to need your journal and something to write with. Exercise 1. Pick a day for doing this exercise, preferably a day when you don't plan to be doing anything dramatic or out of the ordinary. This should be a typical day for you. Keep your journal or a small notebook and pen handy throughout the day. Make a series of appointments with yourself. Every 2 hours, stop what you're doing, take out the notebook, and simply jot down the observations about the self-talk you've been having for the past 2 hours. Each of these note-taking sessions need only take a few minutes. Write down what you've been telling yourself about your appearance, the work you've been doing for the past 2 hours, your job, generally speaking, your intelligence, your competence, your skills and abilities, your worth. If you find it easier not to wait for the 2 hour mark, but instead to jot things down as you hear yourself saying them, then by all means do it that way. The point is to develop a thorough understanding of one day's internal dialogue without completely upsetting your daily schedule. Exercise 2. Imagine that you're scheduled to make an important presentation at work tomorrow. A number of important customers or clients, as well as several of your coworkers and your boss, will be there watching. It's the night before. You're lying in bed in the dark, thinking about the presentation. What are you saying to yourself? Take whatever time you need to consider honestly and thoroughly the kinds of messages that would be going through your head. You'd be having a conversation with yourself, so what would you be saying? Write down as much of this conversation as you can. Exercise 3. When you look back over your writing for exercises 1 and 2, how would you describe the overall tone or mood of your internal dialogue? Is it positive, upbeat, or is it pessimistic, defeatist, self-condemning? If it is positive, is it rational, or is it just some rah-rah self-con job with no substance? Circle any writing that you think illustrates either especially positive or especially negative internal dialogue. Exercise 4. As you look at your writing, answer this question. What kind of friend are you to yourself throughout the day? If you were a friend whispering in your ear the messages you recorded in exercises 1 and 2, what kind of friend would you be? You're the one who talks to you all day, every day. What kind of friend are you? Are you actively creating a toxic environment for yourself, contaminating your experience of the world? Or are the messages that you send yourself characterized by a rational and productive optimism? Now that we've talked about your internal dialogue, I'm going to turn to another incredible